Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about major and minor grooves in DNA. Now, this really came as a shock to me because I've been looking at DNA for a while and just never seen the fact that the actual spring gap between spirals alternates from a large gap to a small gap, from a major groove to a minor groove. And I don't know how I missed this. And to be sure that many representations of DNA, many models of DNA, do not have this feature in it. And it's sort of just the most astounding thing to go. And it sort of, to me, speaks about our sort of sleepwalking into science, sort of looking at but not never really observing. And I sort of know this from being in with a group of, say, 10 teachers on a marking table, and you say something scientific that you know, and the other teachers just declare they've never seen it, never heard of it. And I'm sort of guilty of that as well. And this is not seeing. So normally, if you, say, take out your biro, your spring biro, you see that little spring, your DNA is a helix. And we call it a double helix because it's not just one wire. It's actually two wires. So if I had a spring and I pulled it out, I'd get one wire. DNA is a double helix, so if I pull it out, I'll get two springs out, or two strings out. So if I got a single wire in a spring and I pull it out, it will become a single wire. If I get the double helix, I pull it out, it will form a little long linear ladder, which is okay. And you can sort of see that these are two, this is called a double helix, it's got two ends of it. So let's look at the actual DNA molecule itself. It's got a phosphate, a ribose sugar, or DNA sugar. This is a 5-carbon sugar. No, it's actually all sugars are 6 carbons. I still got to work out. There's a 5-carbon loop. There may be a carbon on the outside. Now, all sugars are carbohydrates. That is, for every carbon, there's an OH and an H associated with it. Carbon has 4 bonds. Two are in the chain or the loop, and one's for a hydrogen, one's for an OH, and the actual DNA is deoxy. So rather than having a OH, that the OH has been removed and replaced with an H, so it's deoxyribose. So ribose, or RNA, and DNA, deoxyribose. So it's just, what can you say, the oxygen's been taken out of the sugar backbone. It means it can fold into a more compact form. RNA is a bit more, flexible, and can make a more complicated thing. DNA is less flexible, forms a nice, well-packed form. There's a whole series of things. So you've got your basic primary structure, which is the phosphate cross-link, which so it goes phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar, and onto the sugar, the ribose sugar, adds your nitrogenous base. Why it's a nitrogenous base is that the two bases are in two groups, and I just am getting back to remember this, A, T, and GC, GT, AT and GC. Now, I've got to remember the two different things. You've got a purine, which is a 6-membered ring, and a pyrimidine. These are the two nitrogenous bases. The pyrimidine has a hexagon and a with a pentagon stuck on it, and has four nitrogens all in all. So there's a lot of nitrogens in there. Nitrogen actually means it's a generally flat molecule, closed in. So the more nitrogen's in, the more charge is there, the more the electrons are pulled into your bond there, these big flat plates. Now, the amazing thing is that when you see the double helix, you know it's a double helix. So if I pull it out, it will form basically a ladder. So if I have a ladder and I had this fantastic way of storing it, I could actually twist my ladder, twist it up into a little drum, and that's what it's like. Now, the difference is that something which I didn't spot is that there's major and minor grooves. So if you put your between the two sides on either side, the two handrails on the side of your ladder going up, and it's all this drum, if you run your hand across it, there's the grooves are not equal, and to this amazing thing, this absolutely knock me dead stuff, is I'm trying to it's sort of like a stroke within a stroke. Like, I'm actually trying to get my memory back and get on top of everything, and then as I go along, I realize that my God, these people, you know, often with stroke stuff, you work and work and work, and you say, oh, I've reached a limitation. Oh, that's how fast I can type. Oh, I've forgotten that. Or I've get this confusion thing, and you realize that. And so that's internally. But externally, you realize, oh, look, the whole of society has this thing that they've missed. And I posit that people have missed the fact that DNA has a major and minor groove. And I sort of, you know, if you ask me to draw it, and all the models I've seen, the groove sizes are the same. And I'm just going, oh, what the heck? And when I look at it, no, the groove sizes are not the same. It actually goes in what looks like a little railway track on the outside. It goes as a little railway track. You know how you've got the railway tracks are close together, and then there's a gap, and the next train moves, the actual tracks. It's like a little railway track of a minor groove going up. So what is the origin of this? And I'm going, gee, this is just, it's just so, so hard. How does it organize that? And it's not that there's four helixes, it's not two springs. Like if I had, what I could have is actually four springs. So if I have two springs, I can actually interleave them, screw them into each other. Now, in this case, the beauty of it is that those springs, two springs, are connected, so I can actually pull it out. So how it goes is actual hydrogen bonding between the purines and pyrimidines. So a six-membered ring binds onto a six-plus pyramid plus pentagon ring. I suppose what you call it's a six-atom, two nitrogens with, or you can have six. I suppose it must be nine. Must it be nine? It's six. Yeah, nine. Atoms in the sort of the backbone of the pyrimidines. So the two, you've got a six and a six and a pentagon. So a hexagon goes to a hexagon and pentagon, and that's how it goes together. You've got two hexagons and two hexapentagons. That's together. I just tapped my microphone here because I'm walking around out here in the rather pleasant bush out as I'm talking here. And there's sort of flies and birds which you can possibly hear about the place. Okay, so you've got this type of thing. Now, my students have always built it such that the A and T go together in a line at 180 degrees and form a straight rung across. That is the simple way they've drawn it, is that the rungs are straight. And without exception, every model of DNA I've ever seen, the rungs have been drawn just straight. And this is obviously not true, because the hexagon, the purine, sticks to the pyrimidine at an angle, not at 180 degrees, but it goes an angle, and so you get two angles exposed. So it's like a boomerang. So in your DNA are actually, in fact, pretty good boomerangs. They're not straight rungs, they're bent rungs. And now this is a big revelation to me. And it sort of gives me the idea. So your DNA, as you hang it up, the rungs from one side, I think the 3-5 and the 5'3" side, the trailing and leading side, they're not straight. You can't, if you were to hang it out to unfold your DNA, the rungs would be bent like boomerangs, and the boomerangs could all spin around, and the actual angle of the boomerang is, rather than 180 degrees for a straight rung, it's 120 and 240 degrees. There's sort of six degrees, so it's actually a full. So if you imagined it as a clock face, so 120 degrees would be 1 to 4, and then 4 to 12. It's at that angle. So it's, say if you had 4 o'clock precisely, you've got a small angle between the 1 and the 4, and a large angle between the 4 and the 12. And that means that your DNA, the rungs, have got this bend in it. And I sort of saw it before, but I just didn't... It didn't all click together about how important this was. So let's see what this does. So, now that fortunately, you can actually have your DNA, that rung, boomerang, has got two ways it can be in. It can be the bend of the boomerang between the two rails can be pointed towards you or away from you. Now, it arranges it. So not only that, it's just sort of bizarre. Now, the thing is that to stick in a double helix, it doesn't have the choice of doing it. So what it means is that you get, where it's 120 degrees, it stacks always 120 degrees, but it means that the back of it, so 120 degrees means that the actual two strands are, so you've got two helixes, so in your helix you've got, you can see two together, you can see the other side, they're not, rather than the back rung on the reverse, the back rung is pulled around 60 degrees, so you can see the two there. So say if I've got two springs interleaved, I can actually, if I have them 180 degrees out of phase, they will be equally spaced. But if I move them really tight together, 0 degrees, the two wires will be next to each other. So it will look like a single spring, but two wires going up. If I just twist it not 180 degrees, 120 degrees, I can see two sides of the same rung, and from the side, and then from the other side, there's a gap of rungs. So it's really interesting to see. Now, what this actually means for DNA is really interesting, in that your DNA ring, the rungs are slightly exposed. So it means that molecules can actually get in. So what it means is that the binding things of your nitrogenous bases are the binding sections are jammed together in the narrow groove, whereas in the larger groove, it's exposed. So you can actually get in and read the actual rung system is sort of collapsed a little bit out of the way, so you can see on the inside, which means that proteins can come in and interact with your DNA and block it and do things without unzipping it. You don't have to unzip it to read it. You can actually read generally your DNA while it's actually spiraled up, which is sort of like a very interesting aspect to me. So let's just summarize it again. The sort of newsflash, DNA is less symmetric than I have previously taught it, than I have recognized it. And this is this. So all models I have done seen is someone's got one. It's got a strip of paper like this. They cut out. They get a strip of paper, and then they connect, you know, A to T, G to C, or C to G, or T to A, in a runk, in a thing. So they get groups of three, they form codons, and it's all nice and flat. And then they get the piece of paper, and then they just off the sheet of paper, and then they twist it. And this generates equidistant grooves. But the actual pieces of paper have a boomerang shape. They're not flat. And this means that your DNA has a double, a major and minor groove. So that's a major thing for me. So that's sort of rather cosmic to try and think that I'm working through this. Slowly rebuilding memory, slowly doing it. But then I see a whole section of DNA that we just simply don't teach. Now, this has a consequence that the DNA that you see in textbooks is not the physical DNA that you see on in textbooks, in the net, and in graphical art. So if it's heaps of DNA is sort of like the iconic new symbol, new age symbol. So if I was going out to Roman ruins, or going to say the Declaration of Independence or anything like that, I saw a DNA molecule drawn there, I would say, well, I don't care if you can actually prove that that was written at the time. I can tell you that this must have been written, because this information was only available after 1950, after Rosalind Franklin and the famous, what was it, water-infused DNA crystal. It was only at that point that it was seen. So I can tell you it's there, but it's interesting that the picture there, Scott Ford, is sort of a bastardized short picture. So most of the DNA molecules you see portrayed is just something easy to understand. It's sort of like the teaching method, in terms of like stage number one, I teach you that there's two backbones and two crosses of the nitrogen, the spaces. And I get you to do the paper model, and I make sure that it's a closed system, that the thing that you produce with the paper model is like the picture I show you, and it's like this closed system and never may enter. This is really interesting for me, in terms of, I like the sort of the zipping, unzipping of DNA, the expression, transcription, the messenger RNA. I've got a really, really this transcription RNA. I've got to really go through the RNAs in my head again. So RNA and tRNA, the T and the U are substituted, the RNA doesn't have. There's two differences of RNA. RNA has got a different set of bases that it uses. So it has a a U rather than a T there, but it also its backbone is got extra oxygen. It's ribose. It's not deoxied ribose. It's just ribose. So if you take the oxygens off it, you go through. And so, yeah, I just really challenge you to look up on the internet minor and major grooves. You may have, look, if I can say my friends, or I don't know whether they are truly my friends, the people who sort of hang around and chat and stuff, I will say, oh look, this is a really fascinating something, and they'll say, look, I know, I've known that for years. And I want to say, well, no, this has just been discovered recently in the last month. But it doesn't matter. Or I will say at school, say, oh, look, that's particularly wrong. We know it's like this. And the person says, I know. And or there may be a case where there's something that I personally have discovered. And, you know, a molecule or something like that I've personally ground through the most esoteric sort of side clues to the molecule, ground it through a computer, supercomputer model, had it reviewed, eventually had it discovered, put it out there, and I'd say, oh look, the world's smallest molecule is this for this reason. Of course, I knew that. And you go, are we in the same reality? So it's sort of this sort of conveyor belt of ignorance. As we seem to know things, we tend to not know things and tend to give ourselves an illusion. We're used to producing the theatre of school, the theatre of understanding, and it's not there. So just to summarise again, it's the major and minor grooves of DNA. And the DNA is at a different point. Now, this really goes down to the basis of it. You have one teacher, like, I think in the 2013, 2014, as CRISPR was coming out, I was teaching that, saying this is the big new thing. And the teachers complained, and they said, oh, only your class knows CRISPR. Oh, well, I suppose we're going to have to change the marking scheme to allow them to talk about CRISPR. Just, well, it's sort of this complete resentment around it. But this is the major problem in terms of a quintessential problem of when... and it's not because I'm an advanced scientist or anything like that. It's just because I keep on working at it until you suddenly see it. And it's sort of like the first step, oh, it should be this way. And but the system has got so much inertia. I look at a house, and it's sort of like someone is used to following a way of building a house, and they pour the foundations and stuff like that. And you say, "Oh, now look, I realise that what you're doing here is that this land's going to subside in so many years' time," and the fact is that they have invested in the concrete and the thing, the whole social infrastructure is for getting it to go forward. But I only say this because I'm walking up the street, seeing a house and thinking of it. But your message gets necessarily put aside, and it's hard not to actually take it all personally going ahead. So look, I can only thoroughly recommend going to the internet, looking up major and minor grooves, and perhaps you'll have the epiphany that I had, that, or you might be there, you might be of this stunned person, or you can actually say, my God, I haven't seen that before, or you could say, yeah, I knew that all along. And in fact, you could probably say that for most things. Now, this is sort of a pretty incredible. Thing here. I'm just walking past a bowerbird. These are these pretty incredible birds, which I had to say, the first couple of years were pretty rare in Glenbrook, and now they're almost a pest. These are pretty advanced advanced birds. So I'll get this, put it up on the internet and see if I can get to learn their purines and sort of note where the oxygens are and note the actual processes of, try and work out why RNA takes a U and not a T, why T can't fit into RNA. There must be something about the difference between U and T which means it doesn't fit with the sugar. And that will be very interesting to try and go. Thanks a lot for listening. That's Peter Hill speaking. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.